The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Let's start with the story that doesn't seem to want to go away, and that is the payment of the Hague judgment, or the settlement claim. So yesterday it emerged in various news reports that the judgment fund, which Treasury runs, had posted, you know, kind of hiding in plain sight, 13 payments of $99,999,999.99, which, if you add them all up, comes to just under the $1.3 billion that you guys had needed still to pay the Iranians. First of all, I've got a couple things on this. The first thing is, one, if you add it all up, you're 13 cents short. Have the Iranians asked for their 13 cents? Or are you guys holding it onto it for leverage in the next for the next release of prisoners?
That's the Associated Press's Matt Lee having a little fun with the State Department spokesman Mark Toner, who's been under fire of late. In fact, later in that exchange, he kind of shot back and said, "Look, if you guys think I enjoy coming out here and taking all these questions." I don't. He's been having to try to answer questions about this story that, as Matt Lee brings out, doesn't seem to want to go away. We know about the $400 million, the details that emerged from last week, the $400 million that was, I guess, owed to Iran over an old arms deal, and that it was held as leverage, to quote the State Department, or ransom, to quote any other observer, but leverage to guarantee the release of those four Americans back on January the 17th. And now we're learning about the $1.3 billion lump sum interest payments that the U.S. made to Iran as well. That happened on January the 19th, just 2 days after we sent those pallets full of foreign currencies as ransom for those prisoners. Here's another bit from that exchange yesterday, clip two.
Which is, these transfers have been made by wire, not paid in actual cash. And if that is the case, I'm wondering why how it was done, and even if you can't answer that, why you couldn't have paid the $400 million in the same way. In other words, what made the payment of the $400 million different? Not in terms of what the money was for, but what made it different than the payment of the interest?
I'm not sure if I can give you a complete answer on that, to be perfectly honest.
And he said there right at the tail end, the reporter did, well, any answer would be helpful. Any answer. That's what they're seeking. We'd like to know why it's so mysterious, why it's clouded in secrecy, why it was hidden, the fact that this $400 million was sent over on pallets in an unmarked plane with foreign currency in cash. And then, almost as strange as that, to have 13 wire transfers of $99,999,999.99. No one's even explained why it was a penny under $100 million. And so he's trying to get answers about now the $1.3 billion. And furthermore, if you had to send over cash, this has been the answer over the last couple of weeks. If you had to send over cash because, well, we didn't really have any kind of a banking relationship with Iran because of the years of sanctions, then why, 2 days later, did you send over 13 wire transfers amounting to $1.3 billion? Lots of unanswered questions from this story that just doesn't seem to want to go away. From this story, as I said yesterday, that keeps pointing us back to January the 16th, Implementation Day. The day that the nuclear deal was implemented. And then the day after that, the lopsided prisoner swap that now included a $400 million ransom. And then here comes the 13 wire transfers to pay the $1.3 billion in interest. One more clip here from the exchange between Matt Lee and Mr. Toner.
We've talked before about the fact that when this... So a couple of thoughts. One is that we did not have a relationship with Iran, bank-to-bank or financial relationship with Iran leading up to this settlement payment that was established or solid, given the somewhat strained relations we've had over the past, since 1979. It was not necessarily an easy or straightforward transaction to make. Now, whether that was later amended, I can't speak to that.
For the
balance, for the interest, that is what you're referring to here.
But you're suggesting that there might have been some change in your banking relationship between the 17th of January and the 19th of January that would have allowed us to...
I don't know.
The 18th, as I recall, was a federal holiday, so I don't... You don't know?
I don't know. And we said we're not going to talk about this.
He doesn't know, and we've said, well, we're not going to talk about this. And so there again, this was from, I believe, the exchange 2 days ago. And then they came out yesterday, the administration, and gave a few more details. But here again, you have reporters and even members of Congress investigating this to try to figure out what is going on. What in the world is going on? And why are these deals and these transactions under a cloud of secrecy? Matt Lee even said, this is certainly, he was referring to one particular branch of the government, saying that it was hardly being transparent, a reference back to what President Obama said coming in 2009, that his would be the most transparent administration in the history of the United States. Yesterday, I quoted from my father's forthcoming article in the October 2016 Trumpet about this shameful hostage deal with Iran, referring to all of these prophecies in your Bible about Iran's aggressive terrorism-empowered foreign policy, as he put it, and then the prophesied emergence of a strongman in Europe, and then the clash between Catholic Europe and radical Islam, and then the prophecies about America's shameful weakness and all of our sins leading to our destruction. He said, through the pages of the Bible, God revealed these prophecies to a man who died on January 16th, 1986. And so all of these most recent events, they keep pointing us back to Implementation Day. January 16th, 2016, 30 years on from Herbert Armstrong's death. My father wrote in that piece, "The fact that the nuclear deal was implemented on January 16th is a great warning to America." It is a great warning to America. Look at what's happened since then. We're only 8 months or so into the year. 8 months beyond Implementation Day. And as I read to you on Monday, Jay Solomon's essay from last weekend, on the big victor, the big winner from the Iran nuke deal, it's the Ayatollah. Jay Solomon said the U.S. hoped that the nuclear deal would boost Iran's moderates, but after more than a year, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei and his allies seem to be the big winners. Well, as we'll see in just a bit later on in this segment, you have to wonder whether President Obama really wanted for this nuclear deal to boost Iran's moderates. Maybe Secretary Kerry did, maybe others in the administration. But has the president really wanted to see the moderates get in power in Iran? Because he's had numerous opportunities to really high pressure Iran into a regime change, particularly when you look back at 2009. I don't want to get ahead of myself, but you look at these most recent events and look at what Implementation Day has done for Iran's position of strength in the Middle East, in Syria, in Iraq, all across the region. I mean, just a couple of days ago, you had this U.S. destroyer there in the Persian Gulf. I mean, right there in international waters. And there it is, harassed by these four Iranian patrol boats that barely looked like more than fishing boats that were chasing off this U.S. destroyer. This destroyer had to actually change its course in order to avoid a confrontation with these four little Iranian boats. They brought to mind what happened back in January with those 10 sailors. But, I mean, in this case, you had this huge destroyer with all this firepower. And it's there firing off flares. It's there sounding the bullhorn. And that's it. That's it, as these four patrol boats come chasing it down. From the Hill yesterday, 2 days ago, I guess, Iran's foreign minister begins Latin American tour with Cuba visit. This is the same one that had all those negotiations with Secretary Kerry to finalize the details on this nuclear deal. And now, I mean, he's a big celebrity in Latin America. He's on tour. He's in Havana. He's being greeted by the Castro regime. Something that that President Obama can't even say when he went down there and wasn't even greeted by the regime at the airport. This article says here, Iran's foreign minister kicked off a Latin American tour Sunday in Havana, saying the Iran nuclear deal has removed obstacles for closer ties between his country and the region. Okay, so here's another domino to fall from this deal, this Implementation Day deal that happened on January the 16th. Foreign Minister Javad Zarif will visit Cuba, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Chile, Bolivia, and Venezuela, reported the Tasnim news agency. It says Zarif said he plans to sign oil, energy, and maritime transport agreements during his tour, but the visit is raising concerns with a key Republican lawmaker. So then it quotes this Republican Congresswoman, who said the timing of Zarif's trip is significant, as Iran could use many of these rogue regimes to circumvent remaining sanctions, undermine U.S. interests, and expand the drug trafficking network that helps finance its illicit activities. All of this lawless behavior. It quotes her as saying, Tehran's classic playbook is to use cultural centers, new embassies or consulates or cooperative agreements or various areas to act as facades aimed at expanding Iran's radical extremist network. It says, finally, this is from The Hill, save for Chile, the country Zarif is visiting align with the region's ideological left and tend to have difficult relations with the United States. I think that's putting it mildly. Here he is, cozying up to all of the nations south of America's border that tend to have difficulty, that tend to be hostile toward the United States. Now, think about this development, even with respect to the trade routes, like my father wrote about in that July Trumpet article, China steering the world toward war, talking about how China is just grabbing all this territory in the South China Sea, where trillions of dollars of goods pass through there every year. And as my father brings out in that piece, the movements of the European Union toward South America, entering into all these trade agreements, taking business away from the U.S., and then Russia and China together militarizing those trade routes in the South China Sea and elsewhere. And my father said, this prophecy is being fulfilled before our eyes. He's referring to that prophecy in Deuteronomy 28, being besieged in the gates. It says, America's enemies are securing shipping lanes and creating economic alliances that will very soon enable them to choke off America's supply lines. He was saying that a few months ago, talking mainly about the EU and Russia and China. And then now here's this story. Iran's foreign minister, he's visiting Cuba, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Chile, Bolivia, Venezuela. And it's all possible because of the deal that President Obama was obsessed with making as soon as he came into office. Isn't this something U.S. officials should be worried about? Maybe some are. I think it's safe to say that in the White House, they're not concerned about it. Because from the beginning, this administration, the Obama administration, President Obama himself has been the chief enabler of Iran's emergence as the prophesied king of the South. That's the truth. That's what we're witnessing. That's what's happened. And really, he made that pretty clear from the outset. We have referred back to that Cairo speech that he gave on June 4th, 2009. The new beginning, you know, the Muslim outreach. And notice what he said in that speech regarding Iran. This is clip 4.
Since the Islamic Revolution, Iran has played a role in acts of hostage taking and violence against U.S. troops and civilians. This history is well known. Rather than remain trapped in the past, I've made it clear to Iran's leaders and people that my country is prepared to move forward.
So it has all this, I mean, the track record is well known as he brings out hostage taking, antagonism, violence, sponsorship of terrorism. And yet this was just 6 months into his presidency. He had made it known to the leaders of Iran that he's prepared to move forward. This was the same speech in which he defended instead of condemned Iran's nuclear pursuits. This was the speech that he didn't even mention terrorism. I forget how many words. It was a long speech, 4,000 or 5,000 words. Not one mention of terrorism. Not one. And my father, in response to it, he said, how much did America's president help the terrorist cause? Probably far more than we imagine. Well, I'd say so. And then toward the end of this article, he wrote in response to the president's speech, he called this a great turning point in the world. He said it's going to play a major role in terrifying prophecies of your Bible being fulfilled. Prophecies that revolve around Daniel 11 and verse 40. That clash between the king of the south and the king of the north. The king of the south pushing and pushing and pushing. Everywhere that you looked. I mean, even four little patrol boats can push a destroyer off course. A U.S. destroyer. Well, now, boy, the obstacles, all the obstacles have been removed. And you have the foreign minister now gallivanting across Central and South America, establishing all of these ties, circumventing any sanctions that remain in place, what little there are in place, making trade deals. You would think there'd be more sounding the alarm. Well, we've told you about this clash, this Daniel 11 and verse 40 clash. It comes after the King of the South. That's the Iran-led radical Islamist movement. It comes after their constant pushing at Europe. And then Europe finally responds. One more clip here from the Cairo speech, June 4th, 2009.
There will be many issues to discuss between our two countries, and we are willing to move forward without preconditions on the basis of mutual respect.
Never mind what's happened. Never mind what might have happened even yesterday. Never mind what you say during your prayer calls. Words don't matter if you're threatening us. We are prepared to move forward without preconditions, on the basis of mutual respect. As if the mullahs have respect for President Obama and the United States government. But no preconditions at all. We're committed to working with this Islamist regime. That's what the president said from the start. And, well, did you know that just 8 days after that speech, tens of thousands of Iranians took to the streets in Tehran and elsewhere demanding reform, demanding democracy, demanding that their vote be counted, calling for freedom. They did this after the mullahs had rigged the election in favor of Ahmadinejad. This was 8 days after the Cairo speech, where you had this rigged presidential election in order to keep Ahmadinejad in power. That was the election was June 12, 2009. And Ahmadinejad supposedly won in a landslide. In some cases, there was 100% turnout in the vote, according to the Iranian authorities. And so the people, obviously knowing this is a sham of a sham, they took to the street and said, "Death to the dictator! Give us our votes back!" The day after, June 13th, this again, 8-9 days after the Cairo speech, there were press reports saying it was the biggest unrest since the 1979 revolution. That happened in 2009. And there were protests around the world. There were even 200 or so people outside of Iran's embassy in London. People calling for reform and for change. I mean, this was, if ever there was one, this was a popular uprising. And what was America's response? Well, here's what President Obama had to say. This is June 15th, 2009.
On Iran, the disputed election results and the fact that there's been violence in the street in any way change your willingness to meet with Mr. Ahmadinejad without precondition? And also, do you have anything to say, any message to send to the people who are in the streets protesting, who believe their votes were stolen and who are being attacked violently?
Obviously, all of us have been watching the news from Iran. And I want to start off by being very clear that it is up to Iranians to make decisions about who Iran's leaders will be, that we respect Iranian sovereignty and want to avoid the United States being the issue inside of Iran.
That's another way of saying we fully support the mullahs, the radical Islamist regime. Here you have this popular uprising that was brutally smashed by this radical Islamist theocracy. And his response, the leader of the free world, responded by saying, well, you know, it's up to the Iranians, and we respect their sovereignty, and we're going to stay out of it. We want to avoid the United States being the issue here. And so then the leaders of the uprising there in Iran, they were systematically arrested, then put through a kangaroo court system, locked in prison. And there's some dispute over the casualty count, whether you listen to the Iranian government or to some of those in the opposition who claim that as many as 150 died, thousands of arrests, as many as 4,000 arrested. And the U.S. response was basically, hey, we're staying out of it. And we back the regime, basically. Notice what else. June 15th, this is clip 7.
What I would say to those people who put so much hope and energy and optimism into the political process, I would say to them that the world is watching and inspired by their participation, regardless of what the ultimate outcome of the election was.
He couldn't even bring himself to say that the election was rigged, that Ahmadinejad winning in a landslide, well, it was highly unlikely given the fact that as many as 500,000 people turned out to say, how come our votes didn't count? Regardless of the ultimate outcome of the election, there's no real position that the United States took. Now, as the week unfolded and as the scenes of violence, I mean, you saw people getting killed in the street. The U.S. government came out with stronger denunciations of the violence, but they offered no support whatsoever to those protesters calling for freedom and democracy. Here's clip number 8.
My understanding is that the Iranian government says that they are going to look into irregularities that have taken place. We weren't on the ground. We did not have observers there. We did not have international observers on hand. So I can't state definitively one way or another what happened with respect to the election.
He didn't know what was happening, but his understanding is that the Iranian government was looking into it. So what do you suppose the Iranian government found? Well, that the problem was the protesters. That Ahmadinejad won fair and square, even with these figures of 100% showing up for votes. What an opportunity. I mean, when you look at this long-standing confrontation between the United States and Iran ever since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and here the U.S. administration had the chance to potentially topple an arch enemy and to get rid of the number one state sponsor of global terrorism. As it is, the United States did absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. And in fact, came along and endorsed not only the mullahs, not only the Iranian government, but Ahmadinejad too. They said, hey, we're going to still press forward with diplomacy. The past is in the past. We're going to move forward with mutual respect. No preconditions, nothing. You don't have to do anything. We're just going to move forward with these negotiations. I've made it clear, as he said at that Cairo speech, I've made it clear to the leaders of the regime that this is a new beginning. This is a new beginning, the president said in Cairo. We're not going to be trapped in the past anymore. This is an opportunity for us to move forward. One more clip from June 15th, number 9.
And particularly to the youth of Iran, I want them to know that that we in the United States do not want to make any decisions for the Iranians, but we do believe that the Iranian people and their voices should be heard and respected.
That's what he said to the youth of Iran. We hear you, but that's it. We're not going to make any decisions for the Iranians. We won't do anything for you to help you in this cause. But we do hear your voices. That's the best he offered them. The next day, following those remarks from June 15th, here's what the president said on June 16th.
You've seen in Iran some initial reaction from the Supreme Leader that indicates he understands the Iranian people have deep concerns about the election. It's not productive, given the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, to be seen as meddling, the U.S. president meddling in Iranian elections.
That really is an astounding statement. If you go back and listen to it again, I mean, here he is saying that, look, the Supreme Leader, the Ayatollah, he understands the Iranian people have deep concerns. And then he goes on to say that we're not going to be seen as meddling in this. That's not productive. That was on June 16th, the same day an estimated 500,000 people turned out on the streets of Tehran in protest. And there you have the President of the United States siding with the Supreme Leader. Now, compare that with what happened in Egypt. This is just 17 months later, about a year and a half later, when you had a similar scene. Tens of thousands of people, I'm not even sure there would have been 500,000, I forget. There were a lot. It was another popular uprising. And what did the United States do? What position did the U.S. government take? What did President Obama call for? Well, here's what he said. This was February 1st, 2011, clip 12.
Through thousands of years, Egypt has known many moments of transformation. The voices of the Egyptian people tell us that this is one of those moments. This is one of those times. Now, it is not the role of any other country to determine Egypt's leaders. Only the Egyptian people can do that. What is clear, and what I indicated tonight to President Mubarak, is my belief that an orderly transition must be meaningful, it must be peaceful, and it must begin now.
It must begin now. The transition starts now. That was the position that President Obama took with a pro-American government, one that had been pro-American for some 30 years. And at the first sign of trouble for Mubarak, when demonstrations exploded in Cairo, President Obama made it clear that he sided with the youths. He sided with the protesters. He sided with the Muslim Brotherhood. And he ordered, he demanded an immediate and orderly transition of government. Egypt wasn't the only place. I mean, really, you can look across North Africa and the Middle East, and you see this administration, the Obama administration, a fervent supporter of regime change in Tunisia, Algeria. In Libya, the president went right around the Constitution to get rid of Gaddafi. Strong positions for the United States in those cases. Well, it's not our role to determine the fate of these nations, but it must begin now, this orderly transition. It must begin now, and I made that clear to Mubarak. It's stark, the difference. I mean, even with little Jordan, my father writes about this, I believe, in the America Under Attack book. This was a statement, again, put out by the State Department, the same guy you heard at the top of the show, Mark Toner, It's from 2012, and this is after there were a couple of hundred people that turned out to protest King Abdullah's reign in Amman, Jordan. And the question here is, you know, what do you make of these protests that are happening in Jordan? This is clip number 11.
What's the assessment of why the protests are happening?
Well, again, I think that, you know, this is obviously, as I just said, you know, there's, you know, there are concerns, economic, political concerns, aspirations by the Jordanian people. We believe that King Abdullah's roadmap for reform addresses these, but, you know, certainly, you know, as we've seen elsewhere, there's a thirst for change.
And Jordan, when they heard that, when King Abdullah's administration heard that, I mean, they were outraged. These economic and political concerns. And then a lukewarm endorsement of Abdullah's administration. And then there at the end, well, there's a thirst for change. Jordanians have a thirst for change because of these 200 protesters. Jordan was shocked. My father, in going through some of this in America Under Attack, I mean, here this was, well, 2012, what was it then? 2-3 years after you had tens of thousands, after you had hundreds of thousands demonstrate against a government, a tyranny, a dictatorship, a radical Islamist theocracy, and the Obama administration did absolutely nothing. As my father asked in his booklet, what is wrong with these people? I mean, what is behind this? Well, he talks about, of course, the prince of the power of the air, the god of this world, and how that Satan has been cast down, and how that you're seeing in the current administration heading up the United States of America, how practically every foreign policy decision that's made is not just wrong, it's dangerously wrong. Now, with respect to Iran, you have the liberal leftist media that's quick to provide cover for the administration, saying that, well, you have to understand that 2009, it was early on in his administration, and, you know, it was just more hesitance. The hesitancy was there because he was new to the job. And so when these other cases came along later, the Arab Spring, Tunisia, and so on, Egypt, Libya, well, then he was quicker to lend support to these popular uprisings. In fact, the truth of the matter is that there's a reason this administration has backed just about every popular uprising there is, except for those who sought freedom and democracy in the Islamic Republic of Iran. There's a reason. Eli Lake had a piece at Bloomberg.com today. Why Obama let Iran's Green Revolution fail? Why did he let it fail? What was behind it? He writes here, President Obama wasn't just reluctant to show solidarity in 2009. He feared the demonstrations would sabotage his secret outreach to Iran. In his new book, The Iran Wars, Wall Street Journal reporter Jay Solomon, that's the journalist we quoted from on Monday's show, who had that powerful essay over the weekend. In his new book, The Iran Wars, Wall Street Journal reporter Jay Solomon uncovers new details on how far Obama went to avoid helping Iran's green movement. So we have new details emerging yet again. Behind the scenes, Obama overruled advisors who wanted to do what America had done at similar transitions from dictatorship to democracy and signal America's support. I mean, he had advisors there telling him, we've got to support this. This is a democratic movement. This is a historic opportunity that we have in front of us. We haven't had an opportunity like this since the Islamic Revolution. Here it is, right early on in his presidency. And the president overruled those advisors. It says Solomon reports that Obama ordered the CIA to sever contacts that it had with the Green Movement supporters. Well, they just cut them off. You're on your own. And then there's a few token statements made that, well, we hear your voices, but this is up to you, you Iranians, to decide. And I've actually heard that the Ayatollah is aware. He's aware of your frustrations. And he's looking into the voter irregularities. It says here, the agency has contingency plans for supporting democratic uprisings anywhere in the world. This includes providing dissidents with communications, money, and extreme cases, even arms, Solomon writes. But in this case, the White House ordered it to stand down. It ordered the CIA and other government agencies to not help that Green Movement, to not help that popular uprising in June of 2009. It says further in this Eli Lake piece, that's really a review of this new book, The Iran Wars by Jay Solomon. Eli Lake says here, Obama, from the beginning of his presidency, tried to turn the country's ruling clerics from foes to friends. It was an obsession. It was an obsession of his. It still is. To turn these long-term foes into friends. I mean, he said as much in the Cairo speech. He said he had been talking to the mullahs. He had been talking to the leaders in Iran. And he wanted them to know that this was a new chapter, that this was a time to move forward, that we're not going to be trapped in the past. It's a new beginning. That was the title of his speech. Eli Lake says here, even though the president would impose severe sanctions on the country's economy at the end of his first term and beginning of his second, from the start of his presidency, Obama made it clear the U.S. did not seek regime change for Iran. That's why it didn't act in the case of this popular uprising like it did in every other case, for the most part, because its policy from the beginning was to not seek regime change. And it had that golden opportunity in June 2009. The facts are the facts. I mean, you see the fruits. As Solomon reports, this is from the article again, Obama ended U.S. programs to document Iranian human rights abuses. This is what he did coming in. Okay, we've got to reach out. We've got to extend the olive branch. We're going to make friends out of these foes. And so he stopped U.S. programs to document Iranian human rights abuses. He wrote personal letters, it says, to Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khomeini, assuring him the U.S. was not trying to overthrow him. There's not going to be regime change. We're not going to try to overthrow you. You don't have to worry about that. Obama repeatedly stressed his respect for the regime in his statements, marking Iran's annual Nowruz celebration. You might remember those from YouTube or Twitter or wherever. It was every year. Wishing the Iranians and their leaders a happy celebration with this annual festival. It says here, his quest to engage the mullahs seems to have influenced Obama's decision-making on other issues too. When he walked away from the red line against Syria's use of chemical weapons in 2013, Solomon reports, this is all in his book, both U.S. and Iranian officials had told him that nuclear negotiations would be halted if he intervened against Bashar al-Assad. You see, Iran's there propping him up. And you know all about the red line. Obama said, if that red line is crossed, we're coming in. We're taking action. We're intervening. And Iran said, oh, no, you don't. Because if you do, these negotiations are off. We walk away from the negotiating table. And so then President Obama walked away from the red line. in Syria. Well, this Eli Lake piece talks then about the negotiations for the nuclear deal, the terms agreed to in 2015, and then finally implemented on January 16th, 2016. There were two tracks for the negotiations. There was the one very public track in which America's allies contributed. Britain, the European Union, France, and so on, Germany. But then there was another back channel track that was conducted secretively through Oman. And so you had U.S. officials working there, mostly in Geneva and other European cities, to conduct these two tracks. And then finally they told their negotiating partners about the secret channel back in, I think it was 2013. This article says eventually, now listen to this. This is about the negotiations on the nuclear deal. It says, eventually the Iranians wore down the U.S. delegation. At the beginning of the talks in 2013, the U.S. position was for Iran to dismantle much of its nuclear infrastructure. By the end of the talks in 2015, Secretary of State John Kerry and his team agreed that Iran would then be allowed to build an industrial-scale nuclear program with hundreds of thousands of machines after a 10-year period of restraint. So just 10 years on from implementation day, they're basically on their own. I mean, we're already almost a year into it. So 9 more years, that's it. 9 more years. If you've got a 5-year-old, that's when that 5-year-old is 14. And then the door is wide open, and this is assuming they don't cheat, as I've said before. It says here, other U.S. red lines were demolished too. The final deal would allow the U.N. ban on Iranian missile development to phase out after 8 years. And the arms embargo against Iran to expire after 5 years. It says Iran would not have to acknowledge that it had tried to develop a nuclear weapon, even though samples the Iranians collected at the Parchin facility found evidence of man-made uranium. One last paragraph here. It says, in one particularly revealing passage, Solomon captures the thinking of Kerry, John Kerry that is, who engaged in detailed negotiations after the deal in the final months of the talks. This is quoting John Kerry. So many wars have been fought over misunderstandings, misinterpretations, lack of effective diplomacy. That's what John Kerry told Jay Solomon in an interview this year. He said, war is the failure of diplomacy. War is the failure. That's how he defines war. It's simply a failure of diplomacy. It's a failure of negotiations. It's a failure of talks. If we can just have more negotiation, if we can just have more diplomacy, then we can put an end to these wars that are so often fought over misunderstandings and misinterpretations. Well, what is the lesson from history? It's not that diplomacy has no place, but there was quite a bit of diplomacy in the lead up to World War II, as I recall. Quite a lot of talking with Adolf Hitler. And yet, because the West, because Britain, because the United States wasn't prepared to take action, if Hitler didn't hold up his end of the bargain, well, he just laughed at that agreement. He carried on with his devouring of one country after another, believing there would never be consequences for breaking the agreements he signed. That's right. He lied. He lied. He broke those agreements. And for the longest time, Britain had the track record of ignoring those obvious and blatant lies and aggressions. Well, I mean, you know the history as it carries on. Finally, the West woke up. Finally, there was a Winston Churchill who stood up to him and said, we are going to fight him. We are going to fight until the bitter end. Look at the lesson of history. Look at the truth of your Bible, which says there's a way that seems right to a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. What does God have to say in his Bible about the human heart, human nature, how that it's deceitful above all things and desperately wicked? It's hostile to the laws of God. What does God have to say about the governments of men? What does he have to say about man's pursuit of peace? He says in both the Old Testaments and the New that man doesn't know the way to peace. There is a way, but he doesn't know the way. He doesn't know how to get there. He makes plans for peace. He talks about peace. He calls for peace. But he doesn't know the way. And the Bible says that in the end, the ambassadors for peace are going to weep bitterly. They're going to weep bitterly. Eli Lake is right. That's a revealing statement for Secretary Kerry to make. What a revealing statement that is. War is the failure of diplomacy. It's as if diplomacy will solve all the problems of this world. Rigged elections? Doesn't matter. A brutal crushing of a rebellion? Doesn't matter. A long history of hostage taking and sponsorship of terror? Doesn't matter. Because we're here to talk about peace. God says the ambassadors for peace are going to weep. Weep bitterly. You study the Bible, you see throughout your study that war is pictured as the result of lust or covetousness. It's not because of the absence of diplomacy. It's because of man's nature that we have war. It's because of what God says in Jeremiah 17 and Romans 8 and James 4. It's for all those reasons and more, many more scriptures that we could point to, that we have wars and rumors of wars, just like Jesus prophesied in Matthew 24. The truth is, no human government is able to prevent war or put a permanent end to war. The only solution to the problems of this world, to the problems of war, to the problem of human nature, is God's government. Only God has the power to change that nature. Only God has the power to convert that human nature to the divine nature, to godly character. And how is God going to go about doing that? How is he going to go about bringing it to all the world? How is he going to go about bringing world peace to this earth? Well, it is coming, and it's going to be brought on at the return of Jesus Christ to this earth. That's the only real and lasting solution there is to the many problems of this world. And it's all laid out there, the entire plan of God. It's all laid out there for you in the Holy Bible. God reveals it to those who have eyes to see and ears to hear. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and This is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, I was going to get to a few emails today. We ran out of time, unfortunately. But keep them coming. Send those to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. And we'll see you tomorrow.